Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Life is changing in Australia
because the pub is shut.
Sucked in, fellas.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
I will call it a personal nightmare.
Tell the Prime Minister to go and get...
It is changing all around the world.
I accept your nomination.
The authority is total.
And I rejected that approach.
It's all about acknowledging how far we've come.
He's all tip and no iceberg.
Like a really scary wooden puppet.
He was drunk.
That's not true.
Not now, not ever.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant. You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
G'day and welcome again to Democracy Sausage. I'm Mark Kenny from ANU's Australian Studies Institute and the School of Politics and International Relations. We talk a lot about reform in this country, but it turns out it is much easier said than done. Labor took an unusually bold reform agenda to the 2019 election, featuring an end to tax refunds on share income already untaxed, so-called franking credits or death taxes as the Libs had it, a tightening of negative gearing to losses on new homes only, a halving of the capital gains tax break, and, of course, a 45% cut to emissions by 2030, a cut that now seems modest but which the coalition depicted at the time as a job and investment killer. Together, these things constituted a package of considerable policy merit. Politically, however, it was unwieldy and, in the end, deadly. Regrettably, that defeat has been seared into Labor's memory, and so from big target we seem to be going towards small. This week, the Anthony Albanese-led opposition has ditched the negative gearing change and the capital gains tax rise. Franking credits had already hit the fence, and it has decided after much soul-searching to stick with the coalition's Stage 3 tax cuts, which benefit the well-off disproportionately. Of course, the 45% cut to emissions has also been disavowed. We're not sure what will fill its space. We'll find out closer to the election. Labor, it seems, is correcting the 2019 election at a time when the country and its reliance on the government have undergone unprecedented change. Now, a report by the Grattan Institute looks at why much-needed reform has so often failed in Australia, and it goes back decades to work it all out. I'm delighted to welcome to Democracy Sausage the author of Gridlock, Removing Barriers to Policy Reform, John Daly. John, welcome to the sausage.
It's a pleasure.
Now, look, there are many factors at play here: policy timidity, absent leadership, political party corruption, a feckless public service in which departmental heads now resemble senior policy advisors in some cases, or at least are coming to look more similar to them. And I guess we can't also downplay skittish voters, which is to say that we, the electors, have some role in this as well. So let's go back to where you go back to in this report, which is often held out as the sort of gold standard, the golden period of reform in Australia, the 80s and 90s. How productive was that time, really?
Well, I was always a little bit suspicious that, you know, one read these accounts by journalists and politicians and policy wonks about the golden years of reform. Invariably they were written by people who were very active at the time. And I was always a little bit suspicious that they were just looking at the past with rose-coloured glasses. So we checked. Mm-hmm. And when you list out the things that happened in the 80s and 90s, You know, we had, we floated the dollar, we reduced a whole bunch of tariffs, the Reserve Bank introduced inflation targeting, we had the Accord and the introduction of enterprise bargaining, we had the Hilmer Review followed by national competition policy, we had the privatization of a whole series of government enterprises from the Commonwealth Bank to a series of electricity and water authorities to Qantas to Telstra. We deregulated banking so that foreign banks could come into the country, and then we deregulated telcos. We had all of the ANTS package, capital gains tax, dividend imputation, superannuation, the GST, of course, under John Howard. And, you know, that's just on the economic side. On the social welfare side, you had things like Medicare and so on.
Yeah, but apart from that,
there's quite a lot of change in all that. Yeah. And when you look at the last 10 or 15 years, you know, frankly, the list is just really thin. You know, we sort of privatized Medibank Private, which in the scheme of things doesn't seem terribly exciting. We did push the age pension age up from 65 to 67, which, you know, I suppose is better than doing nothing at all. But again, it doesn't seem particularly exciting. Of course, we had carbon pricing and then we repealed it. We had a demand-driven higher education system and then we effectively have wound that back. We had proposals, at least committed proposals by the government, to push the age pension age up even further to 70, and those got abandoned. We had proposals to cut the company tax rate.
We had work choices, I guess you'd have to say.
We had work choices, which we, of course, also walked back. Whether or not that was a good reform is another question. Yeah. But
it was reform. I mean, it was change. It was hard.
Well, it was hard. I guess we very clearly define reform in company with Gary Banks that it only counts as reform if it's actually a good idea. And so the way that we were doing this was that we were looking at all of the things that Grattan had recommended. By definition, every single one of those has got at least one, if not more, reports lying behind it. And look, chances are you don't agree with us on all of those, but I'd hope you'd agree that we bat better than average. And if all of these ideas that we came up with that, you know, most of them are pretty good ideas, don't happen, then you'd say there was something wrong with the system. So, yeah, short answer is if you look at the history, it really is true the 80s and 90s were much more productive. And then the other thing we did was we looked at the OECD. They put out a country report on Australia every 18 months saying, you know, this is what we think you ought to do. And back in the 80s and 90s and 2000s, early 2000s, governments, you know, did a very large chunk of what was on the OECD's wish list. And over the last 10 years, they've done materially less.
Yeah, so I guess there are a couple of things that can be said about that. It is actually a very impressive list, as you say, right through the 80s and 90s. And there was a lot of political heat. I think some of the rose-coloured glasses, to the extent that they are worn about this period, probably forgets some of the compromising that went on, probably forgets, you know, how difficult it was to force some of these things through, and probably also forgets some of the things that fell by the wayside. And there were a few of those, I guess, as well. You know, Hawke had some battles over things, you know, like the assets test, and of course there was the Australia card argument that came and went, that was you know, pretty bruising. There were probably a few others as well. So there's that aspect of it. The other side of it is also that when we compare then with now, we'll often hear people make the point, and it has some validity, that, you know, some of that was low hanging fruit. You can only privatize those big utilities once. You can, you know, you only float the dollar once. You know, you reduce your tariff walls. You do that once. These are all, that's not to downplay the political difficulty of a number of those things. They did involve, and we'll come a bit later to this idea of sort of party shibboleths, things that parties, you know, identify very closely with in terms of their reason for being and what, you know, how that makes it hard. But that was really, in a way, the secret to a number of those reforms, really, wasn't it? That the parties in power were prepared to, in some cases, take on their own constituents. And you'd say the same thing about John Howard taking on the issue of gun ownership and the distribution of firearms in Australia. That reform involved taking on a coalition, a key part of the coalition base. So those things are acknowledged, but nonetheless, there are many, in many cases, things that you only do once. So what comes after that?
Yeah, well, and I think you're absolutely right. That's a point that the Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, made quite recently, that you can't float the dollar twice. But there are very long lists of things that, you know, most people think would be a pretty good idea that have been sitting there on the shelf for a very long time and making no progress. You know, if you take the Productivity Commission's Shifting the Dial report from 2017, where they identified all of the, you know, things that they thought were really important, most of those haven't happened. If you take the list that Gary Banks put together when he was asked, you know, what's the to-do list? He came up with a to-do list, I think, in about 2012. Most of those things had sat on the shelf for a very long time at the point that he wrote the to-do list. And they're still on the to-do list. if you look at the reforms that Grattan's recommended over the last 11 years, we kind of grouped them up. We grouped those into 73 different reforms. Of those 73 reforms, and bearing in mind that, you know, we didn't invent these things. Most of these things have been, you know, kicking around for a while. Of those 73 reforms, only 23 of them have happened. And the other 50 are also sitting on the shelf. So there's plenty of stuff that's worthwhile that hasn't been done. Now, by definition, it won't be what's been done in the 80s and 90s. So for politicians to say, oh, well, you know, all of the low-hanging fruit got taken in the 80s and 90s and now there's nothing left is just not true. There's just lots of stuff to do. By definition, it's different, but it hasn't happened.
True. And I'm not wanting to run interference for politicians here, but it's not just about the number of reforms, but it's the nature of those reforms. Let's talk Tintac. What are some of the things on the list now, the primary things on the list now, that you think governments could be having a crack at? Because my suspicion is that some of these things, if I can use the vernacular here a bit, aren't that sexy. They're not the kinds of things that necessarily are going to animate voters in the way that, you know, some of those reforms back in the 80s and 90s might have done so.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I think, again, we've got to be careful about the 80s and 90s. You know, I didn't see anyone marching in the streets to float the dollar. reducing tariff barriers was very unpopular at the time. Privatising all of those government businesses was very unpopular at the time and very stoutly resisted.
Yeah.
Introducing a capital gains tax was very unpopular at the time. Heaven knows, introducing a GST was unpopular at the time. You know, like if you took a poll at the time and we looked at those polls, they were pretty clear that most voters opposed GST. Now, interesting, that's one on which voters have changed their minds. So polls today say that voters actually think a GST is a pretty good idea. Interestingly, on government privatisation of government businesses and tariff barriers, they still remain opposed to them. So it was pretty hard, and a lot harder than we remember back in the 80s and 90s. In terms of things that we could do now, you know, lifting the age pension age from 67 to 70 would make a big difference to budgets. It would make a big difference to overall economic output, make a big difference to the retirement incomes of a lot of people, because essentially if they're encouraged to work a little bit longer, they'll wind up with quite a lot more in retirement. It's surprising how much of a difference just 2 or 3 years of extra work makes. So that's one out of 73.
Pretty unpopular.
In terms of taxes, we've kind of talked about those, but one of the, you know, really important ones is swapping out stamp duties and simply raising general property taxes instead, which of course the ACT has done. New South Wales is making noises about doing, I suspect, somewhat emboldened by COVID. The other states have all looked at it and run away because it all just looks too hard. That's on the kind of sort of tax and welfare side. But there's lots more to life than tax and welfare. On housing, we know that the right answer in terms of improving housing affordability is to essentially change planning regulations so that we make it easier to build more medium density housing. Existing residents always hate it. And so consequently, their children can't afford to buy a home anywhere near where they're living. We know that congestion pricing is a good idea. You know, it is an idea that has been around a little while. Singapore introduced it back in 1985. There's even quite a lot of places in the US now which effectively have forms of congestion pricing. You've got reports from people like the Victorian Infrastructure Victoria saying congestion pricing is a really good idea. Governments aren't touching it with a 50-foot barge pole. In health, I mean, there's any number of things that are worth doing, but just to take one particular example, we are still effectively paying the same prices as taxpayers to do pathology tests that we did quite some time ago, even though, you know, the science has somewhat improved in the meantime and there's massive economies of scale and we've just been taken for a ride by the pathology companies and we're still paying the same prices. And, you know, the list goes on, right? And we, in the report that we've written, we've got a helpful table at the back which lists out all of the reforms and, you know, the ones that have or haven't happened. There's a lot of them. The sort of Grattan back book amounts to a pile of reports that's about 3 feet high. And as I said, the vast majority of it hasn't happened.
Well, I mean, there's some good suggestions there, but there's a few things that could be said about them. And I think one thing that probably applies to nearly all of them is that there isn't, and look, this, as you quite rightly point out, this will have been the case with big reforms back in the 80s and 90s as well, but there isn't a strong public clamour for these things. I mean, there might be for cheaper pathology testing, for example, if the case were able to be made, and that shouldn't be that hard a case to make if the technology has changed. But nonetheless, these are things that sort of economists and policy wonks, people who are looking at it, at these areas of public policy, can identify, but a case needs to be made to the public to really get them behind that. I mean, I know, for example, that, as you would, that lifting the pension age basically makes a lot of people fearful. Mm-hmm. They think, oh, right, now I'm going to be, you know, working, particularly for people in jobs that involve any level of manual labour. They're going to think that's just a sort of an unconscionable extension of their working life beyond when they're fit and able to do so. You know, that's how it's going to be seen. So if there's a case to be made there that it has not just economy-wide but society-wide benefits and that it benefit individuals, then that case can be made. The land tax question, you know, the question between stamp duty and land taxes, I hear policy wonks talk about this a lot. And as you say, the ACT's done it. New South Wales is apparently shaping towards that. But I don't think too many people understand why it's a good idea. I wonder if you could tell us why it is a good idea.
Well, maybe rather than kind of going into the detail of why it's a good idea, I think it's particularly interesting to look at the way that politicians have handled them. So again, if you go back to the 80s and 90s, Hawke and Keating spent, and for that matter, many of the other ministers in the Hawke-Keating ministry, spent a lot of the time on the road, on the airwaves, arguing about why the reform that they wanted to introduce was a really good idea, knowing perfectly well that it was unpopular at the time and essentially trying to talk the public around. And even if they didn't get 80% of the public on their side, they at least moved them. And, you know, if you look at some of these issues, you can actually see the polling move over time. So interestingly, on negative gearing capital gains tax, which despite what you might, you know, suspect from reading the papers at the moment, if you take polling on that at the moment, more people think that negative gearing should go than think it should stay. So it's in fact a popular policy to wind it back in the, you know, crude sense of more people like it than hate it. But if you look at the history of the last couple of years, as Grattan Institute and many others really kind of geared up a campaign in about 2015, 16, 17 to make some progress on that issue, public opinion in fact moved and moved in favour of reform. And that was despite the Property Council of Australia and the Real Estate Institute, you know, mounting quite substantial public, you know, advertising campaigns and lobbying campaigns against it. Nevertheless, public opinion moved in the direction in favour of reform. If you think about John Howard and Peter Costello over the GST, I mean, they spent literally a year doing nothing but basically, you know, out there on the hustings explaining in public how it was going to work, why it was a good idea. You know, they didn't get themselves into trouble over birthday cakes like John Hewson, and essentially arguing for the reform. Now, contrast that with the Tony Abbott proposal to increase the age pension age, and it was in the Commission for Audit report, you know, where I think it got a page or two, if that. It certainly wasn't argued in any detail. There was no detail put around it. And then it was part of the formal platform that was taken in the 2013 budget. And then it kind of like, it flopped. I mean, no one from the government said a word about it in public for literally several years. Now, you're never going to change the people's mind about anything if you just sort of have this policy and pretend it's not there and don't go out there and argue about why it's a really good idea. Because the reality is politicians have an enormous pulpit in which to essentially talk to the public, as we have seen over COVID. You know, if you choose to use that pulpit, you get a huge amount of airtime. Now, it may not always be comfortable. You may have to spend quite a lot of time arguing with people who disagree with you, but like that's kind of the point about politics. That's the idea, is that you argue with people who disagree with you, and you know, the public listens on and they no doubt argue with each other, and hopefully at least some of the time, some of them get a greater understanding of the issues and change their minds. Interestingly, I think the New South Wales government is doing not a bad job of this on stamp duty for property tax swaps. So they have actually embarked on quite a substantial process in New South Wales. They've announced, look, this is the direction we want to go in, but we're going to consult very widely. They've set up this process in which lots of people are having their two bobs worth. The Treasurer is out there regularly explaining why, you know, it's a good idea. To be slightly fair to Dominic, wee bit hard for him to get airtime on the issue right at the moment, given everything else that's going on. But he's at least trying when he's got some space. And if you do have that kind of argument, then you have a fighting chance. But it's really interesting that governments have almost never tried to do that over the last decade. And indeed, if we look at this list of 73 Grattan recommendations, 15 of them are unpopular. So in other words, we know that if you take a poll, more people hate it than like it. And of those 15 that are unpopular, not one has happened. Not one. Now, that's really different from the 80s and 90s. And if we're trying to understand why do reforms not happen anymore, the fact that unpopularity has become a complete strikeout has got to be part of the story. It's not the only thing that's going on, but it's a substantial part of what's going on.
Yes, absolutely. And you've called that an insuperable obstacle to reform in the report. I think it's a very interesting point to make, and we'll return to it in just a moment. We'll take a quick break and do so in just a moment.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Okay, welcome back. Now, we were talking about what I guess amounted, John, to a sort of a crisis in politics or a failure of leadership. That is the passing into history of politicians who were capable and inclined to use some of the political capital that comes to them from being in power, from holding leadership, from being in that pulpit, as you described it. We think about all those reforms that we've listed out from the 80s and 90s, and as you make the point, a number of those were tough fights, and we saw political leaders engaging in the art of persuasion, not talking points, but persuasion, wanting to go into an interview, sell an idea, can explain it, in some cases bring people along, in other cases simply get enough people and be prepared to lose some people in the process, in the knowledge that they were operating, you know, in the belief, I suppose, that they were operating in the national interest, that in the longer run, people would see that this was a necessary change. And, you know, the GST might be a case in point thereof. So that's actually, I guess, really what we're talking about here is that professional politics is no longer performing up to the task of driving change.
I think that's right. But I think it's the easy way out to simply say, oh, well, it's all poor leadership. And if we just had better leadership, like that would solve the problem. Because I think it kind of completely succumbs to a great men theory of history, to use the phrase somewhat unfortunately coined by Thomas Carlyle, that history is just the history of great men. And, you know, like great men come along and they do their thing and they shape history. And I think, you know, a much more sophisticated view of history is one that says, look, obviously exactly who comes along makes a difference, but it's the social forces and in particular the institutional structures that we set up that often have a really big influence on what happens, quite apart from the fact, of course, that there's an influence of great women as well. And so I think it's a cop-out to say this is just, you know, the failure of leadership and all we need to do is kind of hope that great leaders come up again. I think what we need to do is look at how our institutions have changed and how might we change our institutions in order that we get leaders who are prepared to do this again. Because I think there's lots of things you can look at in terms of the way that our media works, in terms of the way the public service works, in terms of the way that political advisors work, in terms of what we are prepared to tolerate in terms of political behavior, in terms of the way that the precise rules of the system are working or not working. And if we changed many of those, we would be much more likely to get leaders who were prepared to take on difficult reforms. It's not a certainty, but you at least improve the chances. And, you know, given that at the moment our track record from 15 unpopular reforms is none from 15, at least a nudge in the right direction would be helpful.
Yeah, look, you make an interesting argument there, but I'm just not fully persuaded in terms of entreaties to change our institutions, for example. I mean, that's easily said, but what does it actually mean in practice? And if we think back to floating the dollar, for example, I mean, Treasury was as a sort of a key institution within the public service, the key institution really within the National Public Service, you know, essentially had long for a long time been quite hostile to a floating exchange rate. That no doubt had changed by the time the Prime Minister Paul Keating, or Treasurer as he was then, Paul Keating, you know, drove that reform. But and how do you actually change institutions? And what are the sort of institutions that you're talking about that, you know, what in material terms could change?
Yeah, look, in fact, I mean, that's an interesting one, right? So my reading of the floating of the dollar history is that it was opposed by John Stone, who was Secretary of the Treasury, but was actually supported by a lot of other people in the Treasury.
Indeed.
And, of course, what that says is that it was an institution in which diversity of thought was encouraged.
It's a good point.
And it was actually okay for smart people to disagree about stuff and to express that disagreement. And, in fact, quite a lot of work had been done about, well, if you were going to float the dollar, what would it look like and how would you do it? Even though that was a policy that the then secretary didn't believe in. So in terms of how would you go about changing these institutions, look, there's a long list. The place I would probably start is the Thodey Review of the Australian Public Service, and which was effectively also a review of ministerial advisors that was completed last year. That had a long list of reforms, and basically all of the ones that would have made a real difference were the ones that the Morrison government refused to touch. So, for example, it said we need a more independent public service in which there is less pressure on public servants to simply do whatever their political lords and masters think. And therefore, we need a much tougher process if you want to fire a secretary of a department, more than the current requirements, which is simply if the current minister effectively doesn't like them, they go. And in fact, about a third of all Commonwealth public service secretaries have essentially been fired or moved on over the last decade. Now, that's appalling. I mean, that means that inherently most secretaries are looking over their shoulder most of the time, thinking, I've only got a 2 in 3 chance of surviving here. There are any number of things you could do in terms of the public service itself. One of those is that we used to have a system in which programs were regularly evaluated. And of course, evaluating one program is kind of halfway to developing the policy for the next one. But it's got to be a, you know, proper evaluation in which you're prepared to accept that whatever you're doing at the moment may not be right. It can't be just sort of rubber stamp, you know, we're going to bend over backwards to find that everything's okay. And one could think about some, you know, evaluations of government programs in recent years where, you know, it looked as though someone was bending over backwards to find that it was okay despite the evidence. So these evaluations used to be regular. They've been the first things to be cut when you're trying to save some money in the public service, and there's been far fewer of them. And these days, if they do get done, they are very, very seldom public. So if you don't exercise the policy muscles to do evaluations and you don't make them public to create some pressure for reform, it's not surprising that you wind up with a public service that feels pretty disempowered and doesn't have the kind of muscles to do policy work in as much as it used to. And indeed, there's any number of now former secretaries of Commonwealth Public Service publicly saying that they don't think that the public service has as much policy development capability as it used to. So you definitely need to build that back up. I think there's also a piece around it's often public service is often not being asked to do it. So you had that now somewhat infamous speech and a very much pre-COVID speech by the Prime Minister saying essentially, you know, I would like the public service to focus on implementation and I like my ministers to focus on policy development. Whereas, you know, once upon a time, there was a view that public servants were professionals who had spent their lives in whatever the policy area was. And, you know, at the very least, you should be involving them in thinking about what policy change you wanted to implement. And of course, one of the other things that we forget is that a lot of the policy change that was put through under Hawke and Keating and Howard was put through when their chiefs of staff, so their political, notionally political advisors, were in fact senior public servants or very recently had been senior public servants. And so they were effectively brought across from the public service to work in various ministers' offices. And Don Russell, in his recent book on leadership, identified that group as being one of the really important things that enabled them to push through what was really, in retrospect, a very ambitious program of reform in terms of its scope. One of the reasons that that happened was that they had such a strong network of advisors. Whereas today, if you look at those advisors, only about 20% of them come from the public service. The chiefs of staff are usually people who have essentially worked their way up through the ministerial advisor ranks, as opposed to people who have come across with significant public service experience. There are many more of those advisors than there used to be. Most of them do not come from the public service. As I said, an awful lot of them essentially come from, you know, student politics. They've never had a real job, as they say. And then, of course, they often become politicians themselves. And indeed, increasingly, we are drawing our politicians from the ranks of those advisors. I think a recent analysis found that for about 25% of all members of parliament, their job immediately before parliament was essentially in one of these political roles. And about half of them had worked in one of those roles. Now, if you kind of going back a little bit further than Hawke and Keating, you know, there is no member of federal parliament today who has actually driven a train, as Chifley did.
One of them drove a bus, I think, at one stage, Ben Norton.
So we not only do we have these advisors who are very, very focused on how do I win the media war today for our minister, but those advisors are very focused on how do I keep my record clean so that I can either get a nice job in a government consultancy or get a job as member of parliament. And so you have this enormous force of people who are focused on winning that media war as opposed to asking the question, what would be good for the country in terms of long-term policy development? And that, I think, makes it really hard.
Yes, you're right. And there's a lot of cleverness, almost far too much cleverness in the political caper and not enough deep thought in terms of those longer-term questions, what's in the best interest of the country. I'm really fascinated by the interplay between those two forces that you described there, that is the sort of politicization effectively of the senior levels of the public service by moving those senior public, you know, departmental secretaries who ministers don't like, moving them on, the effect that, the chilling effect that has on the courage of those who remain in terms of being prepared to, you know, stare down a minister and say, no, minister, you are wrong on this. This is the wrong direction. This has all these different reasons why we should not pursue it. And allied to that, the growth of the ministerial office itself, you know, the expansion of the number of people who owe their position, their salary, their influence to the political party rather than to the government and to the ministers concerned. And in my long years working in the Federal Parliamentary Press Gallery, my sense was that there was a greater coming together of these two halves of the senior levels of the public service and the ministerial advisers. There was a growing similarity between the two in terms of the sensibility they brought when you spoke to them. And I think that's actually been a narrowing of policy options and a shortening of the policy horizon in terms of the way the advice they give.
I think there's no question that that's been happening. And the independence of the public service is not what it used to be. So Treasury used to have a thing called the Treasury Roundup in which they published, you know, a dozen articles a year about, you know, interesting stuff. And, you know, they were careful. It tended not to have immediate policy consequences, but you didn't, like, the policy consequences were usually only one or two steps down the track. And it was a substantial contribution to public debate. Treasury secretaries used to quite regularly give substantial speeches that were, you know, not really government policy at all. And they got away with it by saying, oh, well, I'm looking at the long term here. Yeah. But they were very clearly attempts to essentially contribute to public debate. We used to have systems in which when Parliament ran inquiries, departments would make substantial submissions to those inquiries, and they would not necessarily be the policy of the government of the day. They would be the department's view essentially about, you know, what was the problem and kind of like what were the sorts of things you might do about it.
And they could differ from department to department, couldn't they?
Oh, absolutely. Departments disagree with each other, let alone anyone else. And there's a very, there's a lovely story that Martin Parkinson tells about how Keating once got asked on, you know, national television, you know, Treasury's just put out this thing saying such and such, you know, what, you know, like, what do you think about that? And Keating said, well, but that's Treasury's view. That's not the government's view. Now, there is no way that today a department would publish anything that was not the minister's view. There is just no chance of that happening. Whereas, you know, 20 years ago, we were happy enough to have a diversity of thought in which, you know, people put up views and the treasurer was quite happy to simply say, well, look, that's Treasury's view. It's not my view. And, you know, obviously I'm the treasurer, so we're going to, you know, government will be doing what I think, but he wasn't slapping Treasury down and saying they shouldn't have published it. He was just saying that he disagreed with them.
What role do you think the media play in this problem? Because media are often noted for the enthusiasm with which they point out any faint difference between ministers or between what one person says, what one official says, and what the minister might say. You know, any division at all is seen as evidence of dysfunction prima facie.
Yeah. Look, I don't think the media is helping. And the reality is, because of the shrinking of newsrooms, we have fewer expert journalists than we used to. And when you're less of an expert in a policy area, it's much harder to dissect these kind of arguments and say something sensible. And when you're under pressure to file 3 or 4 online stories a day rather than one story, you know, the tendency will be to cut and paste the press release as opposed to, you know, dissect it properly as a journalist should and interrogate it. And, you know, as the famous saying goes, you know, before you write that it's raining, you know, have a look out the window first. So that's part of the problem. Social media obviously makes it harder. The 24-hour nature of online media means that the arguments move on so much faster. That said, I don't think there are insuperable obstacles. I found it very interesting watching Simon Birmingham try to navigate his schools package through. And there's no doubt there were a bunch of some independent schools and organisations that were running interference on that. And he was very organised. He had a ministerial office that was clearly very organised. Every time there was anything in social media saying that, you know, such and such a school was doing really badly because their funding was being cut, you know, literally, you know, within an hour, there'd be something all over social media saying, well, here are the numbers. Boom, 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 boom. This is what they used to get. This is what they do get. This is what the income of their parents is. This is why what we're doing is reasonable. So you can win those kind of arguments, but you've got to be organized and you've got to be determined. And, you know, I think it'd be fair to say that Simon took, you know, pretty substantial hit as a result of being prepared to push through that reform. And you've got to be prepared to live with that and take it on the chin and say, well, this is because I'm trying to get better policy up. So no question media is making it harder. And obviously we've got much more partisan media than we used to and more concentrated media than we used to. And those things aren't helping either. But those, ironically, are things that we can't do very much about. So I guess one of the features of this report that we've just written is to say, look, you know, in the words, sort of bit like that sort of famous Irish proverb, you know, there's a bunch of things that we cannot change. So we will simply have to accept them. And then there's a bunch of things that we can change that will make a difference. And then, of course, we need to have the wisdom to be able to distinguish between those two categories. I don't think there's much we can do to change the media. 24-hour media is here to stay. Partisan media is probably here to stay. Heaven knows social media is here to stay. There are some things we can do on social media. So, for example, the ACCC made some perfectly sensible recommendations about essentially applying the same standards to social media that we apply to conventional media in terms of misinformation. And I don't think that would do any harm. And indeed, it will probably do a great deal of good. And interestingly, I think a lot of the social media platforms are in fact heading towards that direction anyway. And I think January 6 was a bit of a wake-up call to everyone about completely untrammeled free speech has never been part of any society, and there is no reason why we want completely untrammeled free speech on social media either. And, you know, to the extent that things are simply false or defamatory or encouraging violence, then we should shut it down.
We had our own January 6th just a couple of days ago, it seemed. I mean, it wasn't obviously as bad nor as direct, but a lot of misinformation about vaccinations and so forth that seemed to be fueling the anger in those demonstrations in Melbourne and particularly in Sydney. And so I think it's a good example of that. One of the things I think that is interesting about what you're saying about the media environment, for example, is that it raises, and I agree with you, there's a limited number of things that we can do there, but it raises then more, brings more into relief the need for courage, purpose, commitment, persuasion by our political leaders. Now, I know you said before that we can't put all the blame on political leaders or the absence of leadership, but we do need politicians to recognise that they're going to have to sometimes, you know, take their beatings as they come, as Kenny O'Donnell once allegedly said to JFK. You know, some fights you're going to have that you are going to lose some skin, and you've got to be prepared to do that. Whereas it strikes me now that when we've got this process of kind of almost like the toxic professionalization of politics, that every message is managed into a minimalist form where it offends the fewest number of people and opens the fewest number of alternative lines of argument or interpretation. And so it becomes blander and more frustrating and loses its credibility and its force, its ability to drive change. Government is losing its own reason for being to some extent if it can't affect change in the interests of the broader community.
I think that's right. And the question that we try and address in the report, and we can only sketch this out because there's only so much you can do in sort of 70-odd pages, is, well, what do we do about the institutions? So, for example, we can definitely put more controls around firing senior public servants and make that more difficult, much more difficult.
Yep.
We can definitely put limits on the number of advisors there are in Parliament. We can definitely require that more of them have a public service background and simply say there's a quota, you've got to make the quota, and if you haven't made the quota, well, you're going to have to fix that.
And what about making them more accountable? Because at the moment, they exist in a kind of a grey zone. The public servants might be able to be pulled before estimates committees, and of course, ministers can be answerable to Parliament, but they can be answerable to specific inquiries. But ministerial advisors tend to exist in this kind of nether region where they have carte blanche to act with ministerial authority, but they don't carry the same responsibilities.
Absolutely. What Terry Moran, the former Secretary of Prime Minister and Cabinet, described as a black hole of accountability.
Yes.
So there's no question that we can do that. And ironically, we have been prepared to trash any number of conventions over the last 10 or 15 years in terms of the circumstances in which you fire a head of a public service or fire a senior public servant, or the circumstances in which a ministerial is now basically not prepared to resign. I mean, it's very hard to think of any minister that's resigned for either failed policy, and robo-debt, of course, would have to stand as being the most obvious example of a, you know, on a charitable view, it's cost the taxpayer $1.3 billion. On any view, you know, many people have died as a result, and not one person has suffered, as far as we can make out, any professional consequence as a result. Certainly no one in politics has suffered any professional consequence. Any number of scandals that in the past would have brought ministers down. I mean, ironically, history does repeat itself. 20 years ago, a minister in Ros Kelly lost her office for a sports-wrought scandal that was actually much less bad than the kinds of things that have been happening recently. We've been prepared to trash all of those conventions, but the one convention we've maintained is one that says that ministerial advisors can't be, you know, called to account for their actions. There's no reason why parliamentary committees can't. There's no law against it. And there's no question that if a majority of a committee insisted that an advisor show up and answer questions, that would be compelling. There's legally, they have every right to do that. And there's just this convenient detente between the two major parties that says we will never, ever do that. So that sort of thing would help. But I think there's also a lot of things that we could do that would resist or at least try and unwind some of this professionalisation of politics. So we could make it much harder for people to move from ministerial offices into jobs where they are effectively acting as lobbyists for whatever area they've just come from. Ditto for politicians. We can make that golden escalator from politics into working for whichever, you know, industry you've just been regulating or pretty close to it. We can make that a much more difficult transition than we do at the moment. We can really control donations a lot more than we do at the moment. We can require that government decision making be a lot more transparent than it is at the moment. We can, for example, the cabinet in confidence, commercial in confidence exceptions are now just being used for, you know, any number of things where there's no real public interest in keeping it quiet. So if politicians are prepared to essentially abuse the exceptions that have been set up in FOI, well, look, we should frankly just change the FOI legislation so that we really cramp those exemptions back down. And then, of course, and this is the crucial piece to all of these kind of things, you need to have someone actually policing all of this stuff. And hoping that politicians are going to police themselves is clearly not working. So that's why you really do need an independent commission against corruption. It really does have to apply to politicians as well, and it really does have to have some teeth. And of course, what has been put up so far by the Commonwealth government is laughably bad. I mean, toothless doesn't kind of quite capture it. You know, it's kind of like a 120-year-old grandma, you know, who grew up without fluoridation and who can't, you know, like, and whose jaw is too weak to hold dentures anymore.
No teeth, I mean, no appetite.
The Guardian ran a lovely piece recently working out that of 40 substantial scandals over the last couple of years, and, you know, it wasn't hard to come up with a list of 40.
No.
38 of them would not be investigated by the ICAC that the federal government is proposing.
Yeah.
It would be outside its terms of reference. Now, that's a joke.
It is a joke. And much of what happens in politics is a joke. And a number of the things that you've just suggested there would go a long way to restoring faith in the system. And I think, in a sense, faith is the lifeblood of the democratic contract between those electing and those representing. So what you say makes a lot of sense. It would be excellent to see one of the political parties, more likely the opposition, an opposition, propose to make some of those changes. We're running out of time, but I wanted just on that trust theme, and you mentioned Dominique Perrottet before and talking about the, you know, the land tax versus stamp duty issue and perhaps using that as cover, I suppose, for using the pandemic at least as a good time in which to proceed with these changes. I'm wondering if, thinking in Canberra more than in the States, whether we are missing a golden opportunity here for other reforms in your view, because clearly the government's supposedly inching ever so gently towards net zero by 2050. You know, this is the big policy failure of our time, is it not? The energy and climate change plexus, if I can put it like that. Is the federal government wasting now a moment of enhanced trust, albeit that it's on the ebb a bit, I guess you'd say, as a result of the vaccine rollout? But it's been a time when we've seen governments come back into people's lives, and there's potential there to do something with the support of an opposition.
Look, there's no question that a terrific opportunity is being wasted, because if you are going to take on these tough reforms, then having more trust rather than less trust from the public is helpful. If nothing else, because often you'll get a reaction from a substantial number of people, which is, if they do trust you, they'll say, look, I don't really think that the age for the age pension should go up to 70, but, you know, I trust you. You say that you are doing this in good faith. I've got no reason. Like, why would you be doing this if you didn't think it was a good idea? So even though I disagree, you know, like, I'm not going to vote you out. I'll go along with it. And that's the kind of attitude you need to build good reforms. And the reality is trust in politicians has been falling like a stone. Now, ironically, the Morrison government made a big play about how trust in government, i.e. the public service, was falling, for which there is no evidence. Trust in the public service ironically bottomed in about 1985 and has been increasing since then and is materially higher than trust in parliament or politicians. That said, trust in parliament and politicians jumped a lot as a result of the pandemic. and for all the reasons that, that you've outlined. And it jumped further in Australia than it did in, say, Italy, the UK and the US, I suspect because the public in Australia perceived that their governments had actually done, relatively speaking, a much better job of dealing with the pandemic. And I think that's probably true. We may have had a slightly easier hand to play, but we played it, no question, a great deal better.
And we saw the Federation working and people really rewarded that as well. They could see their political leaders at state and federal level talking to each other and cooperating, particularly through 2020.
Look, I think that's right. And the reality is that the state governments sometimes made decisions that the federal government wasn't very happy about. And by and large, those decisions turned out to be really good decisions.
Yeah, they saved everyone.
Indeed. So we have had this big jump in trust in government. I don't see the Commonwealth using it. And as you say, the obvious policy failure of our time is climate change. Australia has essentially got way, way behind the eight ball. And ironically, it's not even going to help us economically. I mean, you know, you can see this coming down at us like a steam train that, driven by Ben Chifley, Europe almost certainly, the US very probably, then probably an awful lot of other countries will effectively impose some form of border tax adjustment. And that is just going to be bad for Australia, given where we are at the moment in terms of having nothing that looks remotely like a carbon price on anything. And indeed, on the government's own projections, no material drop in emissions in any sector other than electricity as far as the eye can see. So we're just not serious about this, and we know we're not serious about it. So in that world, yeah, that's an enormous policy failure. I think the interesting question is, in terms of all of the institutional reforms we've been talking about, have governments got any appetite for those? And, of course, the answer is the two major parties have got no appetite at all, because for the people who work for them, so for the politicians and the advisors, these reforms will be very bad. They would mean that their professional lives are much more complicated and, frankly, much less certain and probably materially less well remunerated. So they, the turkeys are not going to be voting for Christmas anytime soon. And if you look at the history of these kind of reforms, there's only two circumstances really that I've identified in which they happen. So the first is if you have an ongoing theatre in which the poor governance becomes blindingly obvious to everyone and it's running on the evening news, not just for one night, but night after night after night after night, then this thing can start to bubble to the top of public attention. So it's terrific that the Auditor General calls the government, for example, on its car porks. But, you know, that's a story that'll be around for a week or two and then it will probably disappear and it will never really bubble to the top of public attention. What does work is if you have a Fitzgerald-style Royal Commission, as you did in Queensland, or if you have an ICAC, as you did in New South Wales, where you hold public hearings, and inherently that makes terrific theatre for the evening news. If you do that, then you can see the public reacting to the fact that it's on every single night. So when you have these kind of public hearings, you do wind up with enough public pressure to do something about the institutions. Now, of course, that doesn't happen very often, and it usually happens when government calls a royal commission into one thing and for whatever reason it heads off into another direction and it's then too hard to shut it down, which is essentially the kind of thing that happened in Queensland. The other circumstance in which we get material institutional reform is when independents hold the balance of power. If you look at the last 15 years, the only serious institutional reform we've had at a Commonwealth level is introduction of the Parliamentary Budget Office. And there's no question that in terms of fiscal policy and the ability of oppositions to develop good policy, it's been immensely helpful. And the reason that it happened was that it was very explicitly part of the deal that the independents did with the Gillard government in, was it 2010, in which they said, we are happy to back you, but one of the conditions, and it was all spelled out in a very public 10-page agreement, one of the conditions is a Parliamentary Budget Office, and it's roughly speaking going to look like this. And then that's what got delivered. And once it was set up, it takes on a life of its own. My suggestion to the independents, who are already, in fact, heading in this direction because they do have a political interest in pushing this kind of thing. They're already pushing for an ICAC. They're already at a federal level pushing for, you know, substantial controls and better disclosure of donations. They're already pushing for tighter controls over lobbying and more disclosure. I would add to that list some of the things that the report was recommending in terms of, you know, better controls over circumstances in which ministers can dismiss public servants, better controls over the appointments so that, you know, we really are sure that they're appointing people for the right reasons rather than because they just happen to hold the right views, much tighter controls over ministerial advisors. You know, I can see a world in which independents hold the balance of power and they include that wish list as part of the conditions. And of course, when they're holding the power to appoint a government, that does tend to focus people's minds, ironically, on the short term so that they wind up agreeing to those demands, which then can have a very material impact on the long term. Yeah. And I've been, Verona Burgess for The Mandarin wrote a piece yesterday saying, oh, John, how realistic is that? To which the answer is, look, when you've got six or seven independents in a parliament of 150, their chances of holding the balance of power are materially pretty high, you know, like just roll the dice enough times and they will wind up being in the middle.
Yeah, that's true, particularly because you get recalcitrants on the fringes of those major parties who are aware of their centrality to the government's numbers as well. So you get just a greater power that starts to associate with those votes that could be swing votes in the middle of the chamber.
That's right. And it's worth remembering, most of those independents in the lower house are actually centrists.
Yeah,
because
that's true.
We've got single member proportionate electorates, you know, you can't get elected from the fringe to a lower house seat. You have to come through the middle. So the Helen Haynes and the Zali Steggles of this world are inherently centrists. I mean, you know, Bob Catter by Queensland standards is probably a centrist too.
Yeah, just not from this century. John, it's been terrific talking to you, and it's a fabulous, very, very rich report with many, much quality in it, many good recommendations. It's been good just sort of scraping the surface of it today with you. Thanks for joining us on Democracy Sausage.
It's been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you very much.
And that's Democracy Sausage for this week. We'll be back next week, of course. Until then, bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.